Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Stephen Williams is a writer and investigative journalist. His reputation was solidified by the continuing success of two books, Invisible Darkness, The Horrifying Case of Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka, and Carla, A Pact with the Devil, which were critically acclaimed as apocalyptic stories set in landscapes of suburban deviance. His nonfiction work has been compared to that of Norman Mailer and Truman Capote. Stephen has been twice arrested to do with his writing, once in 1998 and again in 2003, criminally charged with over 100 counts of disobeying court orders and publication bans, twice put on trial over an eight-year period between 1998 and 2005, and twice exonerated. The Attorney General, Michael Bryant, also sued Williams in 2003 as an enemy of the state, alleging he was in possession of sensitive court documents. The lawsuit sought unspecified damages and the seizure of Williams' research and archives. Although the courts and police seized his computers and files, the lawsuit did not succeed. The dimension of these attacks on a writer are unusual even in totalitarian regimes, but in democratic countries like Canada and the United States, they are outrageous and speak to an ugly streak of sublimated totalitarianism. These events not only turned the writer into a prominent character in the stories he was documenting, too well for the authorities' liking, but were also vile attempts to denigrate that work and controversialize and even criminalize him. In recognition of same, Stephen was given the Hellman Hammett Award by the Human Rights Watch. The award is presented annually to journalists who have been prosecuted by totalitarian regimes such as China and Iran. The book that we are featuring this evening is Invisible Darkness, with my special guest, journalist and author, Stephen Williams. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Stephen Williams.
Nice to hear from you, Dan.
Thank you for returning to discuss Invisible Darkness. Again, a true crime classic, and our audience will find out why. Let's start, because we have this introduction that really, I think, will be a surprise to our American and international audience. Let's start with, tell our audience where you were in your career when you heard about the arrest of Paul Bernardo, and when did you decide or were enlisted to write about this case and become inextricably involved in this horrifying case of Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka? Tell us about that.
Yeah, actually, it was a winter, a very ugly winter up in the country, and I was sitting at my desk on a Sunday afternoon and thinking that my life wasn't going quite the way I wanted it to go. I'd been working in advertising and public relations, even though I'd written a dozen or 15 feature magazine pieces and then gotten distracted by the pursuit of money and capital and prestige, and thinking that it was time that I really focused on something different. And I was going through a number of newspapers as well as I want. I used to collect the papers and then look at them on a Sunday, when I noticed a long article in a tabloid newspaper, very long for a tabloid journal, of four or five folio pages describing the rest of Paul Bernardo in St. Catharines, Ontario, which is very close to the American border. It's about a 10-minute drive from Niagara Falls, both Canadian and American, and a sort of depressed town because it was reliant on the auto industry, and that was in some disarray at that point. And the idea that this sort of, you know, well-educated accountant person had been arrested suddenly in St. Catharines for, at that point, all that was known was that he was being arrested for the Scarborough rapes, a series of rapes that started in 1987 and concluded in the early 1990s, that he was being arrested for those. And in the bottom parts of the article, it described the fact that he lived in St. Catharines with his young wife, who was a veterinary clinic assistant in, you know, native of St. Catharines. And I thought to myself, there's something wrong with this situation. There's something wrong with this scenario. Serial rapists are very rare at any rate in criminal history, but the idea that this guy was down there living with a young, attractive woman and was in fact married to her, and my question, I just decided to write a note to a half a dozen publishers that I knew, saying, you know, the real question here is, what was this woman doing while this man was out raping and pillaging?
Right.
The real question to be answered is that question. It was about a paragraph or maybe a paragraph and a half, the shortest thing I think I've ever written. And because I really struck me. And so I sent it out to a half a dozen publishers. This is a Sunday afternoon, in those days, by fax. And on Monday, I had three offers to do a book, plus an offer from an international publisher who said that we would do things to make sure that we got an American and a English deal. So that's how it started. I was reading some newspapers on a dark winter afternoon up in the country, and there you go. No one had any idea. No one. The one thing to make clear is that no one, first of all, no one, there were two or three other newspaper people who did books on the case eventually, but no one had ever asked the question about the woman, and no one, and I didn't know what the situation was with her, or if there even was a situation.
Let's start with, because we can't go right to the beginning, and most people have a really good sort of framework of what this story is about, but of course your book goes much, much further. Let's talk about the situation with Vince Bevan. At the same time, the Scarborough rapist, as you said, he was on the loose from 87 till 94 or 90s. So let's talk about the situation in what we call the GTA, the Greater Toronto Area, now about 6 million people or so. And we talked about, you mentioned the St. Catharines are a little small place outside of Toronto, near Niagara Falls. So let's talk about the Green Ribbon Task Force that's assembled at the same time that Vince Bevan is in St. Catharines.
Right. St. Catharines, even then, was sort of a bedroom community to Toronto. And that's how to locate geographically. A great number of people that lived in the nicer parts of Niagara on the lake, where the Shaw Festival is, very close to St. Catharines, a great number of people commuted to Toronto or were ex-Torontonians living in the very nice area of the Niagara Parks and Niagara Falls, all that sort of thing. The interesting thing about Vince Bevan, who was eventually made the what's the word I'm looking for, the head or the chief or of the Green Ribbon Task Force, the task force that they established to look into what became multiple strange sexual homicides, was basically a hometown boy from that area whose father had been a policeman and basically a policeman's son from a policing family, who was one of the few guys who had gotten an education and actually had a university degree and had sort of become involved with information technology, IT, you know, and police applications for IT. And somehow, over a period of some months, because this all was a mystery, they didn't apprehend Nardo immediately. The story goes back to, you know, even years, where he was free and inexplicably free, and the Niagara Regional Police, where Vince Bevan was employed, were not getting anywhere, et cetera, et cetera. But at this point in time, when he was arrested, he had been made the head of the Green Ribbon Task Force, which was a task force that refused to have anybody from the Toronto Regional, from the Toronto Police Force involved. And let me rephrase, I've got that wrong. The Green Ribbon Task Force was formed from a series of smaller police forces in and around the region, Hamilton, Burlington, Peel, whatever. But the Toronto Police Force, who were the people who actually identified Bernard as a rapist, would refuse to have anything to do with this task force that was formed under Vince Bevan. So you have a regional task force that is antithetically set up against the major police force in the whole region, which is the Toronto Police Force. It's like setting the New York Police Force against, the force in New Jersey or Connecticut or something, right?
Sure.
So you've got this guy heading up a police force that is a task force that has 12 or 14 different police force members working in the task force, and it's in antithesis to the force that's actually caught the forensic evidence that brought Bernardo to their attention, finally.
Now let's talk about Bernardo is questioned. And so let's go back to when Bernardo is questioned, not arrested, but questioned. Who does the questioning? What do they ask him? What do they get from him? And then what is his reaction and the conversation with Carla? Because I think that, well, we know that that is important in this story.
Well, it's certainly interesting. Prior to his arrest, which, if I'm not mistaken, it's a long time ago. I mean, it was prior to the O.J. Simpson trial in 1995. So I think it was in 1993. But prior to Bernardo's arrest, he was interviewed once by the Metropolitan Toronto Police way back in, I think, 1990. And the Toronto Police that interviewed him, they were interviewing him on the basis that he resembled a composite sketch of the Scarborough rapist. He had been raping women in Toronto. And they interviewed him on that. And for a number of reasons, partly because he was a character very much like the detectives who interviewed him. He was about their age. In Toronto, these two detectives interviewed him. Both were university educated. That happened in Toronto. They were young. They were very fairly good looking, attractive guys. And when they sat down to interview Bernardo, they had nothing except a few people saying he looked like a composite drawing. And when they looked at him, they thought, well, he looks like a guy just like us. So no antenna went up. And the problem was, in those days, DNA testing was a prolonged issue. And they had hundreds of samples from various rapes and murders and whatnot in the forensic center at the Toronto Police Force. And since these guys didn't have a feeling about this guy, all the samples they had continued to sit on there on the shelf in the lab. In the meantime, Bernardo walks away from this scenario thinking that he's invincible. Because clearly there's nothing going to happen. He goes down. At this point, he has a relationship with Carla in St. Catharines. He's still living with his parents in Scarborough. He goes down to St. Catharines and tells Carla that he's the Scarborough rapist. Basically tells her that he's a Scarborough rapist, and they just interviewed. And he's hysterical about it and whatnot and this and that. And she does a coroner. So the sister's death is ruled accidental or death by asphyxiation caused by, you know, vomiting. Mm-hmm. And so now you have a man who has committed, a half a dozen, maybe eight or nine rapes in Scarborough, gotten away with it, at least is the way he sees it. Decided to move into his fiancée, in quotes, house with her parents, and, you know, with her help, successfully raped her younger sister, except it wasn't that successful given she died. And now they're in a house that is hysterical. Still there, Dan?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so Paul and Carla decide to move out because the parents, naturally grieving and hysterical, decide that it's not the appropriate time for them to be married, but they're not having any of that, so they move out and they rent a house in a high-end area of Niagara region down there, in a sort of suburban area right on Lake Ontario called Port Dalhousie. They rent a house there, and then they continue on their way.
Now, for those people that are shocked by the rape wedding present, Christmas present for Paul Bernardo, we're doing this out of order, but because this discovery doesn't happen to much, much later. And so tell us what was their plan after Tammy had been accidentally killed? They've gotten away with it, but what is their plan after it? What do these two people cook up? And if you can go through what they did even in Tammy's room with Tammy's clothing, videotaping, tell us a little bit about that before we talk about Jane Doe.
Well, first of all, there's an argument to be made that Tamlin's death was at least second degree murder. There's arguments to be made that neither of them intended her to die, but there's also a very strong legal argument could be made that they knew enough that this what their actions would their actions would produce death. So therefore, it would be at least second degree murder, but
certainly
that's beside the point because they got away with that. The next project is that it's almost hard it's very hard to describe. A lot of people in Hollywood and in television and have had very great difficulty sort of even comprehending this aspect of the story. They decide that she decides her parents aren't worthy. They don't care about her enough. And she decides she'll move in with Bernardo in this sort of pink Cape Cod style house in Port Dalhousie on the water. And what they will, actually, I even have lost track of what came first and what came second. But certainly, one of the next things that happened in the period of time that they were planning their wedding, which they were deeply engrossed in for a period of about 4 months. Tammy Lynn's murder happened in December 1990, and by end of April, if I'm not mistaken, they were married in Port Dalhousie in an old church and whatnot. But in between, Paul Bernardo abducted a young teenage girl in Burlington while he was out late at night looking for license plates to steal, and brought her home. Her name was Leslie Mahoff. She's a 15-year-old schoolgirl, normal schoolgirl in Burlington, Ontario, and brought her back to this house they had in Port Dalhousie. And over about a three-day period, both he and Carla sexually assaulted Leslie and then murdered her. And so that happens, and they dismember her body in the basement, put her body parts encased them in cement, and dump them in a reservoir that feeds Athens called Lake Gibson, and go off to their wedding. And on the very day that they're being wed in a sort of white horse-drawn carriage deal, which includes 100 of their closest friends and family at a quite lavish sit-down dinner at the Queen's Landing, which in Niagara-on-the-Lake is a very lovely hotel that many Americans are aware of. And during that very moment, the body parts are discovered in Lake Gibson by a fisherman, because Bernardo had been responsible for making sure that they had bought to put the body parts in needed time to coalesce. And he didn't give it enough time, so a couple of the lids that contained these body parts separated in the water of Lake Gibson, and neither of them had done enough research into the Lake Gibson and how it worked. Reservoirs, raise it and go down according to the usage. Some of these cement blocks in which the body parts were encased were exposed, and they separated. And a fisherman found them. And of course, so the police came and found these body parts of someone they weren't even sure was missing on the shores of Lake Gibson. So by the time the police they figure out who the girl is, as of course there are a number of missing girls around a 100-mile radius, they figure out it's Leslie Mahaffey. Bernardo and Homolka have already gone on their honeymoon to Hawaii and come back. So now we're at the stage where both of them think that they're uncatchable and invincible, because nobody's talking about – nobody seems to know anything about what might have happened to this poor girl, Leslie Mahaffey. The Tammy Lynch situation is behind everybody. And now they're just living in this lovely house in Port Dalhousie, coming back from their honeymoon. Very bizarre situation.
Tell us about the abduction of Kristen French and Carla's participation in that.
Well, should we mention the fact that there's been Jane Doe between that abduction?
Yes.
Absolutely. I mean,
yeah.
We probably should bring Jane Doe into this.
Absolutely.
The young woman known as Jane Doe, because this is an astounding sort of fact in the story. That
absolutely. Yeah.
Shortly after. They returned from their honeymoon. Actually, you know what I think? I think that Jane Doe factored in before Leslie Mahaffey was kidnapped. I think I somehow remember that Bernardo asserted that Mahaffey was reciprocal, a sort of reciprocal gift for Jane Doe. But regardless, it's all in my book and very minutely detailed. At some point in this incredible insanity, Carla decides that she needs to do something for Paul, something special for Paul. And she lures a young girl that she'd met at the veterinary clinic and the pet shop that she used to work at. Who also is 15 and strangely looks very much like Tammy Lynn, her sister, dead sister. She lures her over to this house in Port Dalhousie one evening and does to her exactly what she did to her sister so that Paul could rape her sister with impunity. And that is, she got more halothane from the veterinary clinic anesthetic, which she well knew was very dangerous to use with anyone who had eaten anything or drunk anything or had any other kind of suppressants or tranquilizers or whatever. She got exactly the same drug and used exactly the same pills. It was halothane and temazepam or something. The pill has a strong sedative. And she put Jane Doe down in their new house in Port Dalhousie and called her husband on the phone and said, "Come home, dear. I have a present for you." And so they came home. And the other thing that I haven't mentioned is they videotaped all of this. They videotaped Tab Lynn, and now he comes home and finds her with Jane Doe, her little friend, 15-year-old Jane Doe, and the two of them rape and assault Jane Doe and videotape the whole thing. And in this particular case, and I think it predates their going on the honeymoon, because yes. I think it's 6 months after the death. It's less than 6 months after the death of Tammy Lynn. And just a bit before Leslie Mahaffey is murdered.
Right.
And so Jane Doe doesn't die. She's fine. The next day she feels sick. She's sick for a couple of days. She wanders off. And then they go and get married and they go on their honeymoon to Hawaii. Come back. There's no consequences from anything that they've done. And time goes by. Paul is restless. Carla goes and recruits Jane Doe again. And a kind of relationship between the three of them develops that lasts throughout the summer of 1991. Yes, I think it's the summer of 91, whereby Paul and Carla keep encouraging Jane Doe to have relationships with him, but she won't go any further than giving Paul oral sex. So eventually they both get very frustrated, and they actually put her down again the same way they did the first time before they're married, before the honeymoon. And this time, Carla perceives that Jane Doe stops breathing and calls 911 the way she did with Tammy Lynn. But
right.
Then calls them right back and says, no, she's fine. It's a false alarm, no problem. And no one follows up on this. And, you know, and so that incident passes. Jane Doe walks away finally from this bizarre household and survives. And in 1992, the two of them decide that they need to find a new sex slave, and they plot to go out and kidnap a schoolgirl, St. Catherine's schoolgirl. And that's when Christian French is killed. Are we still on?
Yes, we are.
Good.
Now, Christian French is abducted by the couple. And how do they? What's different or similar with what they have done? What they're doing with Christian French?
Well, a lot of water has gone under the bridge by this time. It's April 1992. The difference is that there's a collusion. A lot of stuff has gone down between these two, and tension's building, and, you know, things aren't perfect. I've got a beeping in my ear. Is that you or is that us here?
We'll just continue, yeah. Stephen. Continue.
Okay,
Stephen.
Just keep doing it?
Yes. Yeah.
At this point, she decides that it's imperative for her to assist him and calm him down because he's getting a bit disassociated. And they hatch a plot to kidnap a schoolgirl. And they go out on the street on a very nice afternoon at Easter weekend. And they go cruising looking for someone to kidnap. And they see Kristen French walking home from school. Her walk home from school is about 5 minutes. And they pull off in a church parking lot and pretend that they're looking for directions, something that happens very, very frequently in St. Catharines because of the way in which the city has been designed. And they call her the car and they kidnap her right in broad daylight and take her basically 5 or 6 minutes back to their house in Port Alousie and proceed to rape and then over the Easter weekend in 1992.
Now let's fast forward a little bit because Carla Homolka gets the bright idea that the gig is up. What prompts her? She is contacted by police. Let's get to that point. Let's fast forward to that point where she is contacted
sure.
and makes the smartest decision of her life, let's tell us what prompts this questioning of Carla. What do the police say at that point, and what does she do in reaction to that interview, that questioning?
Right. The problem with this story is it's more complicated than Game of Thrones. And probably French is killed. Things are done. She's dumped in a gully very close in on a back road, very close to the cemetery where Leslie Moffey has been the second victim has been buried. And that Christmas in 1992, Mr. Bernardo was assembling, and he hits Carla with one of those big black iron flashlights, steel flashlight, to such an extent that her mother and other people realize that she's in some kind of trouble. And it's decided that she will leave the Bernardo household and she will go to her uncle's place and live in Brampton. And everything will be forgotten and everything will be fine. At least that's what's in her mind. She wasn't battered, or there's no background of battery record of any kind of problem in their marriage up to this particular moment in 1992, after French is dead and things have gone haven't gone awry. Actually, nothing's happened to implicate anybody. They're none the wiser. But he dissembles. He's a problematic figure. He has no tolerance. He's obviously crazy, but not legally so. And he hits her one night, and that's the end of their relationship. In other words, the first thing she does, she's hit, is leave. And she goes up to live with her aunt and uncle in Brampton. In the meantime, the Metropolitan Toronto Police, the police who have not been involved, the Green Ribbon Task Force that was formed under Vince Bevan and has all this time been investigating unsuccessfully and have twice interviewed Paul Bernardo and cleared him, as had the Toronto Police earlier in the Scarborough rape investigation. The Toronto Police and the forensic lab in Toronto identify Bernardo as the man who has raped three of the 12, 14 victims of the Scarborough rapist.
Right.
So this is the definitive moment for the Toronto Police. They finally solved this case. They've got the guy. And they go down to St. Catharines and put him under surveillance and decide that they're going to arrest him in very short order. But of course, to do this, you have to check the Attorney General for the province. In Canada, the state is the province.
Right.
You know, the feds are the police from Toronto, like the police from New York. I decided that they're going to go into a place like New Jersey, and they're going to take somebody out from under the New Jersey police and arrest them and take them back to New York to prosecute. Well, that isn't going to happen. And it's that the Attorney General insists that the prosecution, the people involved in those decisions, insist that they put Bernardo under surveillance and then decide what to do as time evolves. In the meantime, Carla has left town and gone up to live in another small, suburban development with her aunt and uncle, about an hour and a half away from this place. So the Metropolitan Toronto Police are very, very eager just to arrest him, never mind all of this nonsense, this political nonsense about jurisdiction and whatnot. But Bevan and the Green Ribbon Task Force, the local people that have been charged with this, are insistent that they that this is their caller, that they need to get him. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge political issue involved here that's impossible to talk about. The bottom line is, as the Metropolitan Toronto Police are being held up, they decide that part of their job would be to go and interview his estranged wife, which they do. They find her up in Brampton, in this suburb, and they go up and interview her. And Carla doesn't say anything to them about what actually has gone on. She doesn't confess. She doesn't do anything. But what she does realize is that she could be in deep shit. So they come up to visit her, and she talks to them, and in the process of talking with them, realizes that there's a problem here. These people they're actually on to him, involved in these murders, and that's not good for her, because all she wanted to do was forget about all this stuff. In her mind, she just made a mistake. She married the wrong man. So instead of coming clean with the Toronto Police, she shuts and jives. And the moment they leave, she phones a lawyer in Niagara Falls, and happens to be a very prominent lawyer, perhaps the most senior lawyer in that area, who does nothing but criminal law. She knows this man because his wife brings their Dalmatians to the vet clinic where she worked. So she phones him, and the wife organizes for her to come down and see, his name is George Walker, come down and see George. And she actually has the temerity to ask the detectives from Toronto that were interviewing her to drive her to her appointment with George Walker.
Amazing.
Which they do, of course.
Incredible.
So it's a story that is so complicated, although these kinds of stories seem to be in vogue now, or how else would Game of Thrones be in its sixth season? Or how would The Wired have gone for 7 years? I mean, it is extremely complicated and nuanced, but at the root of it is the fact that policing is a bureaucracy. It's not an effective, force for security or deterrence. It's a bureaucracy. And the moment that you get into more difficulty and more conundrum, the moment you start mixing territories and districts and police. And of course, the Ministry of the Attorney General's or the Prosecutor's Office, whatever they're called in the various jurisdictions in the United States or here, you bring those guys in, and they have their agendas. So the bottom line is, Carla goes down to this lawyer's office, and from that moment in time until the moment he walks into a courtroom to be given a 12-year sentence, not for sex crimes, not for murder, but for two counts of manslaughter, nothing happens, and Bernard is arrested by the Green Ribbon Task Force and Vince Bevan, and of course charged only with the murders of Leslie Mahaffey and Christian French. And, you know, basically that's what Invisible Darkness documents, rather traditional. It's a very traditional true crime story that follows all of the characters, whether they're perpetrators or victims, or the very many fascinating people that inhabit the expert witness program, the psychiatrists and the psychologists, the lawyers and the judges, the senior police, senior media. It's just an epic story of a disaster.
One thing we didn't touch on when we talked about Carla Pact with the Devil, and it's interesting as well because it's one of the most fascinating cases ever written about, is Perfect Victim. And I interviewed Carla Norton earlier this year about the incredible book, The True Story of the Girl in the Box. And
right.
The compliant victim of a sexual sadist. So please explain this, because this is a cornerstone for those that are going to explore this book. It's a cornerstone to understand a little bit about the Perfect Victim story and how much and how important that story and that story is to this story.
That's a very interesting point, because the compliant victim of sexual sadist is a fiction that there's FBI profilers out of Quantico manufactured out of whole cloth. And the basic idea is that there are certain women who are susceptible to sexual sadists so far to such an extent that they marry them and then do their bidding. And this is very much a part of the plea negotiations, or the, if you will, the government here, the prosecutor's office and the government, very much part of their explanation, rationalization for letting Carla literally away with murder. And grotesque murder, not just, I inadvertently murdered my aunt because I was mad at her. All of these girls, with the exception of her sister, who is totally inexplicable, were strangers. So, there's no solace or no explanation in the idea of, you know, the fact she was a battered woman, and acting, you know, out of the battered woman syndrome, and therefore couldn't leave him or anything. The fact is, Carla, the moment she was hit first, the first time she was hit, she left the marriage. That's totally antithetical to the diagnosis of a woman with post-traumatic stress disorder or battered woman syndrome. But the greatest fiction in all of this stuff is that there's a certain kind of woman who is very susceptible to a sexual sadist, and the anomaly here is the compliant victim description, the compliant victim of a sexual sadist. And that's what they claimed, that's what the government decided was the best use of a theory in the case of Carla Homolka. You see, it wasn't a question of what Vince Bevan, the head of the Green Ribbon Task Force, wanted, or the much more powerful and larger and competent Metropolitan Toronto Police wanted. It was a question of how the government was going to deal with a situation that was so high profile, that was almost and so inexplicable, that they couldn't quite figure out a resolution that was going to burn everybody. And then somebody brought up this idea, that it was then quite a new idea, of the compliant victim of the sexual sadist. One of the behavioral science, the behavioral, you call it behavioral science. It's behavioral fiction that comes out of Quantico. But those couple of detectives that worked with the FBI, Hazelwood, Douglas, who came up with it, I'm not sure if Douglas was already gone by that time, but a guy named Roy Hazelwood and a few others had come up with this theory based on the interviews they conducted with you, 10 or 12 cases that don't have any real relationship to the details of this case, had come up with this theory, which had just, it hadn't been published. It was in, I can't remember what the academic journals call it, but it was in review, peer review, and it was about to be published, the idea that, of the compliant victim of a sexual sadist. And this was like a godsend to our government, really, Vince Bevan and the Green Ribbon Task Force, because it gave them an explanation whereby they could excuse Carla for stuff that was inexcusable.
Right.
They could rationalize inexcusable stuff. Yeah, go ahead.
Now, to show the contrast in this trial is that now the government needs this deal. They need these facts to align with their theory. Again, this fictional theory you're talking about, to explain, because obviously she doesn't fit into the post-PTSD, and she certainly doesn't fit into the battered women syndrome by definition itself. Now, what's incredible about your book is that you have, again, factually, having Carla testify and then having Bernardo testify is unusual and incredible. Now, as the prosecution witness, star witness against Bernardo, the defense of Paul Bernardo wants to cross-examine Carla Homolka to benefit Paul Bernardo, regardless of the deal. And so in a bizarre, almost Twilight Zone type scenario where the government has their deal and she has her basically her immunity, she's supposed to tell the truth, and we won't get into all this convenient memory lapses that she has, but tell us about what Rosen exposes, and by that time what everybody in this courtroom basically does know about Carla.
Well, Rosen was Paul Bernardo's lawyer, and the fact is that he didn't believe, and no one believed, that there was any meaningful resolution to happen at this trial, or any meaningful revelation. Because, as the prosecuting attorney said in address to the jury, both these people are guilty of first-degree murder. And I'm paraphrasing, but believe me, the transcripts bear me out. This is the opening to the Bernardo trial where Carla has been dealt with. She's already serving her 12-year sentence for manslaughter, for two counts of manslaughter. Note that it isn't three counts, because that would make her a serial offender. So she's not on three counts. On two counts, and she's doing a 12-year bit, which would in Canada see her out, if she really wanted to pursue it, in as few as 5 years. And she's now coming back to testify against her husband, which is all part of a sort of DeSantisian chart, you know, insane asylum play that the government is putting on for the public. Because the prosecutor says to the jury and to the gathered in the courtroom that please remember that Ms. Homolka is not on trial here. She is a witness for the prosecution. In fact, they are both guilty of first-degree murder, but she is a prosecution witness who has been given immunity. So that's how the trial starts. And then for the next 4 months, about 21 days of which are taken up with Rosen cross-examining a woman who has nothing to fear from the results of the cross-examination.
Yeah.
Bringing out the most amazing descriptions, revelations, and stuff that you would ever hear in a courtroom anywhere in the world. Stunning admissions, but they have no weight. They have no meaning. They have no consequence because she's already been dealt with. So at the end of this, I mean, really, if people are that interested in the dynamics of this, they really have to read the books, which have the most comprehensive and complicated, but I think readable descriptions of everything that goes on and everything that's said. But at the end of the trial, as the trial is concluding in the summer of 1995, the O.J. Simpson trial is still on. The Bernardo trial is concluding on Labor Day weekend, 1995. The prosecutor, the chief prosecutor, says to the jury and to the courthouse that it doesn't matter what Carla Homolka's said. It's irrelevant to the conviction of Paul Bernardo. Nothing wow. she has said matters. We don't care because it's not relevant to the conviction of Paul Bernardo. In law, he's correct. And in fact, that's what happened. Bernardo was convicted. Carla went back to jail. And now it's the 10th, today, this year, not today, this year is 10th anniversary of her release from prison, absolutely free and clear.
Yes.
So, you know, what do you say? You see it happening. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Let's talk about, because we really haven't talked about this specifically. You had these over 100 criminal charges, accusations of looking at releasing sensitive court documents, information that was not allowed, breaking the publication bans. Again, I don't want to get you to defend yourself, but what did you see? I mean, the court listened to the tapes but didn't see the videotapes. What did you see? What was so dangerous on what you saw or what you did or what you released? Tell us about that.
Yeah, nothing I saw or released was very dangerous. So let's the idea that I saw or released or did anything that was dangerous or against the public good is absurd. But, you know, all people are very gullible. So all you have to do is be accused
sure.
of such things, and your neighbors assume you're guilty because they've never even had a policeman doorstep, let alone swarm their house and arrest you at gunpoint with 10 SWAT team people. So all but you know, any government in a democratic society would behave that way over alleged publication ban breaches or court order breaches is insane. It doesn't happen. In my case, what they alleged, which was I had seen when that matter came up in one of my trials, one of my two trials, the press reacted to the fact that there were, the Crown admitted, like 162 people who had actually seen these restricted videotapes. And if the Crown admits that, or sorry, if the prosecuting office admits that, the Attorney General, whatever, I'm looking for a common word that's you know, common to England, the United States here. If the chief prosecutor admits that, how many people actually must have seen them? If 162 people have seen tapes that are allegedly restricted, how many possible, there's probably 500 who have seen them. Now, the point is, I actually didn't see these particular tapes because there was only about an hour and 15 minutes of them, and they were very specific to a certain format, videotape associated with this trial. So, again, the government in this case and the police spent hundreds of millions of tens of millions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of man hours trying to, you know, create a subterfuge around what they were doing that was almost virtually unconscionable. And I was just another subterfuge, just another distraction. The point being, you know, in 10 years, almost 10 years of prosecution, being arrested twice and put on trial for, you know, years, 2-3 years at a time. Millions and millions of dollars spent on prosecuting me on literally over a hundred charges of breaching publication bans and court orders. I ended up pleading guilty to one count, a misdemeanor, which was like to do with my website only, not the books, and only because they had broken me financially. I mean, I would have kept fighting, but I didn't have any money left. I didn't have any property left. I didn't have anything left. You know, I was in debt $500,000. So when the government came to us and said, well, never mind all these criminal charges, never mind this lawsuit as an enemy of the state, just take a plea to one misdemeanor count, ban breach, to do with your website only. Well, a website that actually at that point didn't exist and had never existed. It was it was up on an inaccessible server because we were looking at how to do this.
Right.
They came to us and said, take a plea to one misdemeanor. And because I not only had no money left, I was $500,000 in debt. I ultimately said, okay, we got to do that. My lawyers advised me. My lawyer, Edward Green, is one of the great guys who ever practiced law in North America. He's Clarence Darrow. He's F. Lee Bailey. He's of that ilk. I'll keep fighting. It's entirely up to you. But, you know, let's think about it. Do you want to spend the rest of your life doing this? Or do you want to just take a small, insignificant hit that's not even the equivalent of a traffic violation, like a legal left turn?
Sure.
So, penalty to do with my, you know, you gotta look at a situation like this and say to yourself, how in God's name do these books keep selling all these years? How come that nobody ever sued the bastard for libel or misrepresentation or slander or anything? How come the entire government of his country came against him on criminal charges to do with, you know, how come none of the pushers were charged? So, you know, it doesn't make any sense. And it didn't make any sense, but they do what they do because that's what they do. And, you know, what they did to me was only a minor glitch compared to the morass and nonsense they perpetrated with the case of Paul Berto and Carla Halka.
Let me ask this question, and maybe you've been asked this before, but Do you really think this is about, you had this incredible access to Dr. Arndt. He gave you a couple satchels of everything, access to everything, which I thought was incredible and also very, well, unusual, where you had the diaries, you had the information from the psychiatric tests. You had all of that information that he gave you. He didn't have to give it to you. He respected you, so he gave it to you.
Right. He also provided all kinds of other essential material that were almost was never be gotten in terms of the backgrounds of his patient, all of her school records, all of her medical records, everything to do with her. Mm-hmm. Right, very unusual.
Now, with that information and all the other access that you had and your persistence in this, and again, we have two books over 600 pages, so it's crammed with information. Is this really, bottom line, are they mad because you told the truth? Are they mad that you expose this most, it's beyond controversial, this travesty of justice? Are they, and all the subsequent dealings and all the explanations, are they essentially mad about this?
I don't think they're mad anymore because they're all either dead or retired.
Well, I mean, at the time.
I mean, people don't think about these things. The passage of time is inexorable, and it's, you know, very strange. At the time, I think it was, there were a couple of very powerful men who I had offended one way or the other. And there were other agendas at work. It's very rare, for instance, that families of victims have a rapacious legal representation that really isn't legal, but more public relations, like right. The Fritz Mahaffey family had with a guy named Tim Danson. Every time this case got into the press, money would flow into Danson's office for what was it called? I think towards the end, the Integrity Fund for the French and Mahaffey family. And nothing ever, I mean, it's a sad, sad thing to say, but the person who took the most advantage of those people, the most advantage on a large, not more advantage than the people who killed their daughter, but afterwards, the person and people who took the most advantage of them are the lawyer that represented them and the government used them as somehow, politicians are so glib, they're so fast to hide behind the easiest issues, and in this case, the skirts of mothers of dead girls. It's so easy to go there, and they do. And you know, at the time, I think that all these forces were in play, and I was just a big target. Mm-hmm. And you know, made mistakes. Listen, I'm not perfect. I made mistakes. I, in a sense, on a number of occasions, I was just a large sitting target. And they were there and they took advantage of it. I don't think it's issues of freedom of speech. I think that the issues that caused me the day of hurt and pain and prosecution had to do with personalities and individual. It wasn't business, it was personal, if you know what I mean.
Right.
I think it's certain individuals saw opportunities or had taken umbrage with something I had written or whatever. I can't see it. It's impossible to see it in larger societal terms because they're not there. I mean, they're just... So it has to be personal. And you know, one of the senior people who was involved in the deal making to do with Carla Homolka was ended up as the assistant deputy minister of the attorney general. I happened to mention in my summary in Invisible Darkness that he had been having an affair with his second chair while he was managing the Homolka business down in Niagara Falls, and that he left his wife and three children and married her. And it was only in the back end of the book, and where you summarize a traditional crime book, where all the players, what became of all the players in the case. If you write a good book, a good crime book, you've got a lot of very prominent players and characters, and you've developed them, and in the end, out of a proper form, you summarize what's become of them. You know, have they left? Have they died? What new job have they taken? What's happened to them? Et cetera, et cetera. Well, in this case, Mr. Siegel happened to be the man who was responsible for ordering police investigations at the very moment that, in other words, he hadn't left the Ministry of the Attorney General or the office of the Attorney General at the very moment that the first arrest issue was called for by Tim Danson, the lawyer for the families of the Mahaffeys and Frenches. It was Danson that called for me to be arrested and investigated. And Mr. Wow. Siegel was sitting in the bird seat where he had the power to order an arrest. I suspect that another man would have ignored it. So
I know when we last spoke, I think the root of the problem is, and again, we won't go back into it, but you said, you know, the lawyer's just doing their job, so that's their job. But it's clearly Tim Danson has taken his job and his responsibility to, you know, irresponsible levels and unconscionable levels. I was always disgusted by his behavior, and I'm even more disgusted by what you had said that I didn't know about Tim Danson interfering and trying to get you arrested. I know he tried to ruin your journalistic career. I mean, that was obvious by the press conferences did on behalf of the families. And yeah, it's irresponsible. But what I wanted to say, too, is that he wasn't just doing his job. There was people in this story that weren't just doing their job.
Well, I don't think that the phrase, I don't think the explanation that I was just doing my job is a justification for anything. I think
no.
Anybody who has read anything about German history and World War II would easily accept the idea that just doing the job was a viable excuse. But I'm absolutely sympathetic to that, and you're right to call it out. I mean, I use it as a euphemism. As far as I know, I can't, at least when I was paying attention to this, you know, Tim Danson never actually won a case in court. When he was representing the family, every motion that he brought in front of court was turned back. When he went to the Supreme Court for leave to appeal, the Supreme Court appealed something that a lower court had said is unappealable. It's not a matter for the courts. It's a matter for Parliament. It's a matter for lobbyists. If you want the laws changed, we'll go and stop wasting your client's money and lobby the government. When he ignored that advice and went to the Supreme Court and allegedly, I mean, he said publicly, it was in the newspapers, stuff like that at the time, that it required $800 million for him to mount a Supreme Court challenge. when he mounted that challenge, the Supreme Court wouldn't even hear him. They wouldn't listen to his argument. They said it's not for the court. But he understands how Supreme Courts work. It's a pretty damaging thing. If you go to bring something, try to bring something to the Supreme Court, and they won't even let you argue in front of them why they should listen to it.
Sure.
Say categorically, we don't want to hear anything from you about this.
Yeah.
You know, no. Well, I mean, but people, you know, people don't follow this stuff at all. There aren't many people that follow Supreme Court rulings or pay much attention to what lawyers are doing or who's doing what to whom. And in the end, a lot of people get hurt badly by it, one way or the other, because actually it's one of those areas of life you should pay a little more attention to than most people do. But you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm as guilty as the next man of using that euphemism. They were just doing their jobs. I always say it tongue in cheek, but that's not always evident to somebody listening.
Right. With this as well, I think it's a commentary, and at least that's what I have seen in these few years that I've been covering mostly American true crime writers. It is, I think, a truly unique situation, the true crime book phenomena as a genre in America. When you look in comparison to Australia has a strong true crime market and some fascinatingly bizarre crimes, and so does England. But Canada seems to not have that market, or at least what I see, and I'm going to get you to weigh in, is that based on a bunch of factors, the reluctance from the newspapers to sort of play up, but rather play down some of these things, these cases, the important case, the Picton case, Bernardo Homolka, other important murder trials. Do you see a difference that I see in the public's acceptance of these cases and their interest in following those cases and learning about those cases and being up on those cases? You see a difference, a vast difference, or any difference at all between the two societies and the response to serious and credible crime like the evidenced by Paul Bernardo and Carlo Homolka?
That's a very interesting question and a complex question. And superficially, you could say that Americans seem to have a really overwhelming, superficially prurient interest. In other words, they love to consume all sorts of true crime, almost the way they consume coffee. Or, in other words, they watch it, they don't absorb it in any meaningful way, but it probably has an effect on their heartbeat, their system, like caffeine would. Canadians seem to want to deny that anything bad ever happens, or organize to make it look like law and order prevails,
right?
And so therefore, the presentation or the way it evolves is different. But the strange thing is, I think some of the strangest crimes committed on the planet have been committed by, I don't know why this is somewhat amusing to me, but been committed by Canadians.
Absolutely.
I mean, you don't know of a character like Olson and what he did and how the authorities dealt with him, i.e.,
right.
Buying out, you know, if he tell them where his victims were, they'd give $1,000 each for each victim to his wife and child. I mean, how Canadian is that? And besides that, Olson not only was a peculiar criminal,
but he was also a peculiar and irrepressible maniac inmate. There has been no other crime. I don't believe there has been a crime like the Bernardo Homolka crime in history.
No.
Certainly not since they did it. There is a case in England that was almost a coincidence in time. There's Fred and Rose West case.
Right.
But it is so bizarre and so out there that it's not comparable. For instance, if you look at class structure and a number of other issues, age, class, fashion. There's really no relation to that. And as far as I can tell, that the Rose and West, the West case and the Moore's murders. Those are there are three cases or four cases that have any similarity to the Bernardo case, and nothing like it has happened since. It's so ultra, it's so bizarre. And Canadians also seem to produce some of the most despicable, disgusting crimes, like that Magnata guy in Montreal who cut up a perfectly innocent Chinese student, sent his body parts to the conservative and liberal offices. What the fuck is that about? I haven't seen anything like that out of the United States. I just see
what I'm
like,
seeing.
Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
What I was going to say is that I totally agree with you. In fact, what I had said and stated publicly is that if you look at the case of the photographer in Edmonton that lured somebody on Plenty of Fish and then came up with a serial killer sort of checkbook that he was a script that he was going by to lure somebody in as he was a woman, and then murder and videotape. And then the case I was involved with, Sidney Tierhuis, every graphic, gory, disgusting detail he wanted the world to know. And the murder spectacle that he laid out for authorities with Susan Sarandon's jewelry nearby. And it seemed like after that case, Magnata was influenced by Colonel Williams and, yes, Paul Bernardo and Picton, but wanted to outdo in one murder everyone else by being over the top, by videotaping, cannibalizing, defiling this body, sending it to government agencies. Of course, there's nothing like that in America or the world, because I think Canadians are competing with Americans very much like we would in entertainment, comedians, artists, musicians.
Listen, there's a certain argument to be made on its face for that sort of thing. It's always struck me as very odd how extreme, how extreme certain cases are in Canada compared to international. It's just a matter of degree. It's almost impossible to address, for instance, race-rooted crime that's going on and the gun-rooted crime that's going on in the United States today. I used to say when people would become, there was so much emotion at the time I was writing about the Bernardo Homolka case, that even, for instance, Margaret Atwood even questioned my sanity, even when she was writing Alias Grace, why doesn't he just stop this since they're prosecuting him to this extent? Why doesn't he, just not do this? Canadians don't seem to have any perspective on anything except, polite literature and excuses. But I haven't got any, as my, the, one of the men I deeply admire and have known over the years, off and on, or Cohen, said, "I don't have a secret chart to get me to the heart of this or any other matter. I'm just honestly always just been a guy trying to write a good book and write about something meaningful and look into the odd dark place." The trouble is, when you go trying to do that, you find yourself stuck over the abyss, as I have done. So,
absolutely. Yeah, and inextricably involved in something that, again, by definition, never leaves you. It stays with you. And very much, you wrote these books many years ago. The facts
never
don't seem to go away. I've interviewed a lot of authors that seem to can't remember their books, but I'm pretty sure you won't forget this one. So,
No, in this case at all.
So I'm confident. So.
Anyway, it's good to talk to you, Dan. One more.
Yes, I want to thank you. I want to thank you very much, Stephen, for coming on and talking about Invisible Darkness and your involvement in this incredible case. And we just touched on it. I'm sure readers will be motivated to go and look into these books and read the rest of the details.
I'm pleased to do it, Deb. After a month or two of rest, I'd be happy to talk to you again if you had more stuff together.
Absolutely. This story... is on so many levels demonstrates so much about killers themselves and their motivation. And not only we have a spectacular killer in Paul Bernardo, but then we have a spectacular killer couple with Carla Homolka. And incredible that she's roaming around free and easy in Montreal with a couple children and a happily married. So this is the story that demonstrates so much about killers, but also demonstrates so much about the motivations of jurisdictions and police and government agencies and everybody with their needs. And again, it opens up an incredible door for incredible discussion about so many different things in one book, in two books, covering so much history. And that it's horrifying and true, regardless, is very essential and important history. I want to thank you very much, Stephen, for coming on and talking about your incredible book, Invisible Darkness.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me. Good night.
You have a great night. Good night.
Yeah.